Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. At least 155 million people faced crisis levels of food insecurity in 2020 because of conflict, extreme weather events and economic shocks linked in part to COVID-19, a UN-partnered report said on Wednesday. It's been 5 years since hunger levels were this bad across the 55 countries under review, according to the Global Network Against Food Crises, GNAFC, which said that 20 million more people went hungry last year than in 2019. Countries in Africa remained disproportionately affected, researchers said, with conflict pushing almost 100 million people into acute food insecurity, and economic shocks accounting for another 40 million, and weather extremes 16 million more. In a call for action, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres maintained that conflict and food insecurity went hand in hand. Addressing hunger is a foundation for stability and peace, he said. According to the report, the worst affected countries were Burkina Faso, South Sudan and Yemen. Afghanistan, Syria and Haiti also featured among the 10 worst hit last year. An international hub for pandemic control is to open in Berlin later this year to ensure better preparedness and transparency in the fight against future global health threats, the UN Health Agency announced on Wednesday. With initial support from the German government, the centre will specialise in gathering epidemic intelligence. At a press conference in Geneva, Chancellor Angela Merkel said via video message that she'd first discussed the idea with World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus last autumn. Here's Tedros speaking at a press conference at WHO headquarters in Geneva.
It is a fact of nature that there will be more viruses that will emerge with the potential of sparking epidemics or pandemics. Viruses move fast, but data can move even faster. With the right information, countries and communities can stay one step of an emerging risk and save lives.
A supercomputer will help the centre lead innovations in data analytics across the largest network of global data to predict, prevent, detect, prepare for and respond to pandemic and epidemic risks worldwide, WHO said. The deadly surge in COVID-19 cases across South Asia is unlike anything the region has seen, and there's a real possibility that the healthcare system will be pushed to breaking point, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, has said. According to UNICEF, in almost all countries in the South Asia region, with the exception of Maldives and Bhutan, fewer than 1 in 10 people have been vaccinated. In a statement on Tuesday, George Larrea Ajay, UNICEF Regional Director for South Asia, called for governments to do everything within their power to stop the devastation. Infections have spiked massively across the region, with India accounting for over 90% of both cases and deaths, according to the World Health Organization, WHO. The situation is particularly alarming in Nepal, where there's been a 137% rise in infections this week, the highest level since the pandemic started last year. This has led to a shortage of hospital beds, intensive care units and critical medical supplies, including personal protective equipment and oxygen concentrators. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by award-winning journalist Dave Lindorf from Philadelphia.
If you need any more evidence that this country has turned into a police state, listen to what they've done to Dave Lindorf.
We talk with best-selling author Bruce Levine about his new book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary and Fighter for Racial Justice.
This book couldn't be more timely with the advent of the Black Lives Matter movement and the fulfillment of the American Revolution.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Let's hear from Jim Lafferty, the former director of the National Lawyers Guild out in California.
When historians speak of the Cold War, they're generally talking about that period of time between 1947 and 1991. And it's called a Cold War because the U.S. and former Soviet Union and China were not in direct military conflict with each other during that period. But clearly, the Cold War did not end in 1991. It continues to this day and shows no signs of ending. In fact, the U.S. is now waging at least two Cold Wars, one with Russia and a new and potentially even more dangerous one with China. And these Cold Wars are tragically far from cold. The estimates of the death toll so far that are linked to the decades of Cold Wars runs between 10 and 25 million by estimating the tally from related civil wars, interventions, genocides, and in which the Soviet Union, China, and the U.S. played an often pivotal role. As such, the so-called Cold War would in fact rank as the ninth deadliest war in world history. Now, this horrific death toll is, in major part, a direct consequence of the fact that although the U.S. has not waged a direct military war with either the Soviets then and Russia now or China during the Cold War, hasn't meant that the three nations were not at war with each other by proxy. By supporting and arming one side or another in one or more of other nations' civil wars that have been taking place over the decades of the Cold War. Think of the millions who died in Korea and Vietnam, both military and civilian deaths. Does anyone doubt that the death toll of those civil wars would have been lower had the two sides in the wars not had the backing, military and otherwise, of the world's three major powers, the United States, former Soviet Union, as well as China? And these Cold War nations are still waging proxy wars and cyber wars in places like Syria and Yemen. I saw the evidence of this firsthand in 1971 when I visited Hanoi and other parts of North Vietnam while the war there was still underway. When visiting the War Museum in Hanoi, I could clearly read on fragments of weapons shown in the museum the words, "Made in the USA." Further proof that the Cold War has not been truly cold is found in the answer to this question. Can acts of a government, other than military acts, constitute acts of war? For instance, what about sanctions? After all, sanctions imposed by the U.S. on many nations have caused, untold numbers of deaths and injuries, primarily to civilians in those sanctioned countries. Are not then imposing sanctions acts of war? And what about embargoes or blockades? How about refusals to trade with an unfavored nation? After all, such non-military actions cause death and destruction just as do bombs and guns and tanks. Is the U.S. not responsible for much of the hunger and starvation in North Korea, caused by our continuing sanctions imposed on that nation long after the end of the military conflict there? Not responsible for much of the suffering in Iran, and think about the life-destroying U.S. sanctions and embargoes now taking place against Venezuela. And what about political interference and sabotage conducted by the Cold War countries? Was not the U.S. orchestrated overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953, the first democratically elected prime minister of Iran, an act of war? Or our aid and backing of the 1973 military overthrow of the Salvador Allende government in Chile? There are other myths as well about the Cold War, the notion that it brought stability to the world, that it halted the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and here in the United States, that it kept communism from overrunning our nation. Yeah, here in the United States, we were told it was because we had to stop communism before it reached our own shores through the so-called domino effect. And so, in the name of stopping the spread of communism, we not only experienced the McCarthy-era witch hunts, ruining untold numbers of American lives at home, we also sent our sons and daughters to die in foreign lands like Korea and Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. And we spent trillions of dollars on military hardware that should have been spent on domestic needs instead of making obscene profits for corporate America. And as I say, the Cold War continues with Russia and grows hotter every day with China. 2 weeks ago, President Biden called Russia's Vladimir Putin a killer and has since imposed at least 13 new sanctions on Russia in response to Russia's alleged interference in our 2020 election. And, of course, the U.S. continues deploying warships armed with missiles in the waters off China. And now, Biden and corporate America want the government to spend over $27 billion in new anti-China military readiness in response to Admiral Philip Davidson's claim that, and I quote, China is the greatest strategic threat of the century to the United States, close quote. And top officials in the Biden administration, including Biden himself, have said they agree with him. So the never-ending arms race gains ever more speed. It is important to understand why the ruling elite of the United States still so desperately needs boogeymen to frighten the American people with, be it Russia or China, and thereby continue their deadly cold wars. Because no matter how far those countries have strayed from true communism, making them the boogeyman still provides political cover for the U.S., political cover for corporate America to continue to manufacture military hardware, and for the U.S. to continue its imperialist practice of gobbling up the resources of weaker nations on behalf of ever greater corporate profits, be those the resources of other capitalist nations or pseudo-communist nations. Most critically, we the American people, and especially the peace movement in America, must put aside the notion that so long as the U.S. is not engaged in direct military conflict with other nations, that the conflict is not a real war. It is only a cold war. Put aside the notion that millions of lives will not be lost or maimed in such a war. Put aside the notion that if our troops are withdrawn from Afghanistan, that our war there is over, even if we are still imposing death and destruction on that country through sanctions and other Cold War weaponry. The world is in crisis, brought about by hundreds of years, largely, of capitalist-caused wars and spoliation, and the Cold Wars that are, in truth, hot wars. They continue. That, in fact, there is no such thing as a Cold War. So we must remember if we are not to give up in despair, that we have fought against America's wars in the past, and that we have won great victories for peace in the past, and that, therefore, history itself is on our side. We must remember that things can change, but only if we, the people, have the will to change them, and that wars can be stopped, but only if we, the people, have the will to stop them.
Philadelphia-based journalist Dave Lindorf learned in spring 2019 that he was on the FBI's terrorist watch list. Placement on the list requires special searches of international flyers to and from the U.S. It's readily accessible on computer to all domestic law enforcement agencies and most corporate security departments. Lindorf is about to bring a case against the government over the list on First Amendment grounds. He's being represented pro bono by attorney Baruch Weiss, partner at the major D.C. law firm of Arnold & Porter. Previously, Weiss had been a deputy lead counsel to the Homeland Security Department shortly after it was created. Weiss wants to add to the case any other plaintiffs who may have First Amendment grounds to challenge their suspected inclusion on the list. Examples of First Amendment issues might be a journalist who has written stories that challenge a government policy or an agency. If that was followed by a sudden inability to get a boarding pass online the day before the flight, it might suggest inclusion on the list. That's also true for human rights or anti-war activists who suddenly find it difficult to obtain early boarding passes. Joining us today to discuss his case is Dave Lindorf. He is a contributor to The Nation and writes also for Salon, the London Review of Books, and Counterpunch. He's founder of the website thiscan'tbehappening.net. Author of four books, Dave was a 1990s Hong Kong-China correspondent for Business Week. Dave, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
Dave, please describe for our listeners your experience at London's Heathrow Airport in 2019.
It was actually two experiences. In March, I flew to Vienna, taking a local flight from Heathrow to Vienna, going with my wife, who was playing a concert of harpsichord and piano on Vienna State Radio in Vienna. I guess it's called Austrian State Radio in Vienna, and actually playing music of Holocaust victims and exiles from the Nazis that were being reintroduced to Austria. So I was there as a tourist doing some, you know, reporting while I was there. And then what was weird on that was I knew right away that something was strange because I couldn't get my boarding pass the night before we left while my wife could. I had to get it at the airport. Otherwise, the flight was normal on the way out. And on the way back, it was the same problem. I couldn't get my boarding pass ahead of time while she could. When we got to Heathrow to change planes, we came in on a European kind of domestic flight at one terminal and then had to change to the international terminal to pick up our transatlantic flight. And on the way there, transiting through the, it's a huge airport, and transiting through the airport between the terminals, there was a security checkpoint where you had to just run your boarding pass through a scanner. And when Joyce went through and took her carry-on with her and went through the turnstile to the other side, and I got blocked, and it said that my boarding pass was invalid, the one that was issued at the ticket counter in Vienna. And so a guy came up to me, and he said, you have to go back around the corner down the hall. There's a transit gate where there are staff that can reprint your boarding pass. So I went there, and my wife was waiting for me on the other side, and they took the old boarding pass, and they said, okay, sir, we'll print you a new one, and they printed a new one, and then they stamped it with a hand stamp and handed it to me, and there was printed in red on it from the stamp, red ink, it said ICE, I-C-E in capital letters, security. And I said, what the hell is this? I thought I was in England. And they said, you're on a list, sir, from your country. And so I said, okay, what does that mean? And he said, you're going to get a special security check. So I went back to the gate. I ran my boarding pass, and it zinged me right through that time. And we went, you know, I was just wondering what the hell's going to happen. And we went into the terminal and went down to the restaurants and got ourselves lunch because they hadn't posted our gate yet. So we're eating our lunch, and as we were just finishing lunch, there was an announcement over the entire airport public address system, Mr. Lindorf, please go to your gate or gate whatever security check. So we got up, and we walked down this long path to our gate, and nobody was there yet. I'm not even sure it had been posted. I announced myself to the guy standing at the turnstile and said I was there for a security check. And he said, oh, okay, sir. And he talked into a walkie-talkie and said, Mr. Lindorf's here. And then it's really ominous. And so, you know, he said, you have to go down these stairs and there are some security people there. So my wife said, I'm going with him. And he said, that's all right, ma'am, you can go with him. So she goes through the gate. She thought I was going to be taken away. So we go down the stairs with our, each of us had a one of those little square rolling carry-on bags and computers. So we go down the stairs, and they said to me, Mr. Lindorf, put your suitcase and your computer bag and any other electronics on the table. And they were two guys standing behind these very ominous-looking metal, you know, steel tables like you see in the vet's office, like an operating table, you know. So I put the stuff on the table. They said to my wife she could sit at the in a couple of chairs that were on the side there. So she sat down and watched. And they went over my computer. They said to open the bag and open my computer bag. So I did both. And then they went over them with a device that had a lot of blinking lights. It looked like something out of a 1950s B science fiction movie, you know, going blink, 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 blink. And they went over the computer, they went over the bag, and I said, what are you doing? And the guy said, we're checking for traces of explosives, sir. And I said, and they did the phone too, and I said, wait a minute, I'm a 71-year-old professional journalist from the United States, and you're suspecting me of carrying explosives in my luggage? And he said, we don't suspect you, sir. Your government does. We're just being told to do this. So I said, okay, that makes sense. My government doesn't like journalists. And the guy said, we know your country has lots of problems, sir. They said, okay, you can board early. And my wife is very good at this, said, why are you only checking my husband's bag? It looks exactly like mine. How do you know I don't have his bag? And the guy said, madam, we were only asked to check your husband's luggage, not yours. Please board the plane. So, you know, so we got on the plane. And I said, so obviously this isn't about seriously checking me for explosives. You're just harassing me. And he said, please get on the plane, sir. So, you know, we got on the plane and waited for everybody else to get bored. And then we flew home. When we went through the border checkpoint at the airport, I think it was Newark for the first flight, there was nothing special. You know, nobody said anything special to me. They winged us right through. They didn't ask for anything. They just looked at the incoming boarding pass and the passport and waved us through, and that was it. So that was the first one. And I didn't really do anything about it. I realized that something was weird there, but I thought it was maybe a one-off thing, so I didn't do anything. And then in May, the end of May, I flew again to England, this time on a film project that was related to, I'm doing a film, I'm a co-producer of a film on Ted Hall, the guy who was a teenage spy at Los Alamos and never got caught and gave the Russians the plans for the plutonium bomb before Klaus Fuchs, and helped the Russians get their bomb by 1949. Volunteered it. He wasn't invited in. It was an interesting guy and an interesting case, and his widow lives in Cambridge and was 90 at the time, and so we had gone there to do 3 days of interviews with her. And so I was coming back with my adopted Chinese son, who's 27 and a filmmaker, and he had come as second camera on that shoot. So the two of us were flying home. So again, I had a warning that something was amiss because Jed got his boarding pass the day before we left, but I couldn't get mine. I had to get it at the gate, terminal when we left. And so, we flew to England, no problem, no special check, nothing. Did the 3 days of filming, and then I couldn't get my boarding pass on the way back. So I said to Jed, you know, we better leave early for the airport because this may be problematic, and so I want to give us plenty of time so they don't make us miss a flight. But I think I'm going to be pulled aside for special inspection. And my wife had told Jed, stay with your father if they take him, you know, take him anywhere. So don't let them take him away without you. And so we get to the airport, and this time a woman at the counter gave me a boarding pass, and I noticed there were four black S's on it in the top right and the lower left. There's SSSS in bold. And I said to her, what are these four S's? And she said, oh, sir, that means that you're on a list from your Homeland Security Department and for a special inspection at the gate. So I said, oh, okay, I know what that is. And so we went off, and we went to our gate and hung out. And before they started to board, there was an announcement made from the counter at the gate. It was a little different than the last time. And it said, Mr. Lindorf, please come to the desk. So we went up to the desk, and he said, Mr. Lindorf, you have to have a special security check. Please come around the counter and go through this door. So behind him was a door. And so Jed came with me, and we opened the door and went in. And there were two guys again with the same kind of metal table in front of them. They said, will you both put your bags on the desks and on the tables? And I said, No, my son doesn't have to do that because he doesn't have any S's on his boarding pass, but I do. And they said, right away, they just said, oh, your son can sit over here and wait for you then. So Jed goes over with his bag of camera equipment and his bag that's the one my wife had, and mine was on the table. And this time they ran those, you know, those wipes that the police use for gun tests and stuff. They wiped it over the zippers of the bag. They didn't even open the bag to do it. And then they wiped my computer, and they wiped the phone, and then they wiped my hands with another cloth or paper. And I thought that was kind of strange because I think they have to test those rags. I don't think they just show up that there's explosives, but maybe I'm wrong. But they did the wipes, and then they did paw through my suitcase kind of disconsolately. And I said the same thing. I said, why are you doing this to me? I'm a well-known American journalist. I'm 71 years old, and I don't think I fit a terrorist profile. And he said, you're on a list from your Department of Homeland Security, sir. And I said, okay. And he said, you know, you can board the plane now. And so this time I took my wife's role, and I said, how come you're letting us get on the plane? How do you know my son doesn't have the bomb? And he looked at me and he said, please just get on the plane. And so that was that. When we came back, it's also interesting. We flew. My son wanted to get off early because he was living at the time in Baltimore, and our flight went, it was a cheap flight. It went to Washington, and then I had to board a local flight to get back to Newark to pick up my car, and my son got out in Washington to go to Baltimore on a train and get home a lot earlier. So anyway, and it was late at night. So, you know, when I got out, and we went through customs in Washington, and then I went into the local part of the Dulles Airport, and so I was out, and then had to go back in through security, and nothing happened on the way to the second plane. So flying on a local flight, they don't expect you to blow anything up, I guess.
Dave, in 2002, you actually wrote an article about Barbara Olshansky, who was then with the Center for Constitutional Rights, being stopped at Newark International Airport, even ordered to pull her pants down. Is the same level of watch list activity in effect now, and have the demographics of people being on that list changed, to your knowledge?
Actually, when I did that article, Barbara's a dear friend of mine and a co-author of my book on impeachment, and she was actually being stopped all the time, as was, you know, her boss. She actually went out and bought a pair of a set of underpants with flowers on them and stuff to have her underpants look better when she flew, because she knew she was going to have her pants pulled down. But the situation then was that I learned that there were two lists. One was a no-fly list, and one was a harass list, which was being used for political reasons, like people like her and a nun who was flying down to peace demonstrations in things like the School of the Americas and stuff, a 70-something-year-old nun in her habit. And so that was the story I did then. What's happened is that the list has metastasized, and now there's like four lists. There's a no-fly list, which is very short, basically, a few, maybe tens of thousands at most, of people that they suspect of terrorism but don't have enough on them to arrest them. So they just don't want, you know, real suspicious terrorists that might blow up a plane to get on a plane. And then there's this selectee list, they call it, which are people who are, you know, 1, 2, 3, or I think it's 3, maybe 4 degrees of separation away from a terrorist. And then there's something called the expanded selectee list, which is people who are further removed from that, you know, the selectee list, but the worst, and there's altogether, there's like over, the FBI has said in a court case that there's over a million people on the list. And they're not, most of them aren't vetted. And I think there's an additional list, which is like me, which are people are who are there for political harassment, because I don't have any connection to terrorism, certainly that I know of. I mean, I don't write about terrorism. I've never been to a war zone. You know, I just do investigative journalism, and I haven't ever interviewed a terrorist or anybody who knows a terrorist.
Dave, let's talk about your lawsuit. You're bringing a First Amendment claim. What arguments will you make?
Well, my lawyer, who is Bruce Meyer, with Arnold and Porter in Washington, is a pro bono lawyer that was arranged for me through the Rutherford Institute. And he's actually a former deputy counsel for the first iteration of the Homeland Security Department. And he's pretty outraged by this and thinks it's, you know, a case of the list going off the rails. He wants to do discovery to find out the all-important question of who put me on the list, because the list is, the FBI says that any federal agency can nominate people for the list. They use that word, nominate. So I made the list. I don't know what list I made. They don't tell you if you made a list. They won't confirm it, and they won't tell you how you got on, and they won't tell you who put you on, and they won't tell you how to get off. So we want to know who did it.
Dave Lindorf, have other journalists been targeted the way you have?
There have been cases. There was a case with an ABC reporter, I think, and I think there's been some others. There was a photojournalist who found out he was on it, but it wasn't the no-fly list type. Well, I mean, it's really wrong to call it a no-fly list. He's on the terrorist watch list, but he couldn't get through easily back into the country. He's an American at the border when he was photographing the border problems during the Trump administration, and found out he was on a list, on a watch list. And, you know, with the ABC guy, I think they used the clout of ABC to get him off. That was my understanding. But I don't think he ever knew the details of how he got on it, or, you know, who put him on it. And we're putting out the word to try to get other people who have experienced this, because we're happy to add people to this case. So anyone hearing this out there who's had this, please contact me, and, you know, we'll talk about adding you to the lawsuit.
Dave, have others sued because they suspect that they are on one of the lists?
Oh, well, they know that there's a lot of people on the list. Most of them are people with Muslim names. There was testimony that the FBI actually puts people on the list to intimidate them into becoming informants in Muslim communities in the U.S. so that it makes it hard for them to fly, maybe even the no-fly list. So that's a kind of extortion. And it's totally being misused. But They did admit in federal court, district court in the Fourth Circuit case, that the FBI is supposed to vet every nominee, but that they don't vet maybe even 5% of them. They just put the names on.
How do you get off?
There is no way to get off. They tell you that you can file on their online thing for it's called a redress number, and they issue you a number. I now have a redress number, and they said if you have the redress number and you put that in when you're trying to get your boarding pass, they will usually allow you to get your boarding pass issued, but it doesn't get you off the list. It just means that there's a procedure for letting you through that far, but you may still get a special security check.
We just have a few minutes remaining, but you noted in one of your articles that the CLEAR Legal Clinic at CUNY Law School has reported that the number of people on the selectee and no-fly list have grown significantly since 2014. Now, that was the last time there was a hearing about the list in Congress. Is there going to be another hearing, do you think?
There may be somebody from The Intercept who's on it, too, and that may have had to do with writing that story. I'm not sure. But it's grown since then. It grew under the Obama administration. It grew under the Trump administration, and it's still growing, I gather. There's one point I do want to make, and that is that this is not just a slight inconvenience. The list is made available to every police officer with a computer, which means that if I get stopped for a routine traffic stop and a cop bothers to run a make on me, I'm going to pop up as being on the terrorist watch list, which could make my traffic stop a much more dangerous and serious event for me. And I'm a white guy, but, you know, it still could be nasty.
How can people contact you or your attorney if they want to join in on this?
Well, you can run my email. It's dlindorff, D-L-I-N-T-O-R-F-F, @gmail.com. And I can kind of vet the case and see whether it's a type of case that we would want to add. The main problem is we want people who have recent experience with being on the list, not old cases.
What an important case this is, Dave. We will put this up on our website and hope that some of our listeners will spread the word for others who've gone through what you've been going through.
I hope people do come to me on that because we'd like to get more. One thing I'd like to point out really quickly, and you could maybe add this yourself, and that is that we haven't filed it yet, and the reason is because there was this case in the Fourth Circuit. And it got a good decision at the district court level, which ruled it unconstitutional on how you get on it and how you can't get off it. And then it was overturned on appeal just earlier this month, I think, or else late last month. And so they've asked to have it, CARE is the main plaintiff, and they've asked to have the full court, appellate court, review that decision, but the likelihood is it'll remain overturned. So we're going to file in the Third Circuit if that happens, at a whole new case at the district court level. But we're waiting until I have to go back to England in June, so we want to see if I'm still on the list.
Get a fresh case for that lawsuit, a fresh example. Well, Dave Lindorff, we want to first congratulate you on your 2019 Izzy Award and for all the wonderful investigative journalism work that you've done over the years. And we wish you the best with this lawsuit and want to, you know, touch base later to hear how it's going.
Okay. For now, I'm driving very carefully.
Right. Yeah, just don't drive in Minnesota. Right. David Lindorff, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. And every success with your lawsuit.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave.
The 1861 to 1865 American Civil War and the Reconstruction period, which followed, is considered to be the second American Revolution. The slave-owning planter class in the South was defeated, at least for a while. Slave labor was abolished, but came back in other forms after Reconstruction was crushed in 1877. The promise of the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal before the law was fulfilled, at least for a while. Pennsylvania Congressman Thaddeus Stevens was the foremost leader in the struggle, even more so than Abraham Lincoln. Stevens helped to bring about the destruction of slavery and was a leader in the effort during the Reconstruction period to make the United States a biracial democracy. This wise and eloquent revolutionary has been vilified and rendered obscure since he died 153 years ago. The distinguished historian Bruce Levine, in his just-published biography of Stevens called Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary Fighter for Racial Justice, has secured a place for him alongside his contemporary John Brown in the pantheon of American revolutionary figures. We speak today with Bruce Levine. He's the Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Illinois and the author of four books on the Civil War. Bruce Levine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Bruce, why is the Civil War and Reconstruction that followed it called the Second American Revolution?
Because what it does is overthrows the economic and social order in about half of the country. Slave labor was the basis of the economy, political structure, social relationships, even the culture of the southern states. And by abolishing slavery, those societies were indeed revolutionized. More broadly, the first American Revolution, the War for Independence, began a process of democratic revolution by pulling the land out from under the control of the British Empire and establishing self-government for the region. The Second American Revolution sought to democratize that society further by extending equal rights to all.
Thaddeus Stevens, like Abraham Lincoln, was a very successful lawyer. He was originally from Vermont, but he moved and practiced in Lancaster County in southern Pennsylvania. Then he went to Congress representing the area of Pennsylvania. What political values and morals did he bring with him from rural Vermont? Please talk about the influence of his mother and her Baptist faith.
Vermont had a big impact on Stevens. I'm absolutely convinced. Earlier biographers have paid very little attention to this fact, but Vermont was the most radical of the early states in the Union. It was born in a struggle against the state of New York, which was politically heavily influenced by enormously wealthy landowners in the Hudson and other valleys who owned estates as big as modern counties and whose tenants had few, if any, rights, property rights, political rights, what have you. Vermonters, or what became known as the residents of Vermont, struggled against that control, struggled to own their own small farms, and the state of Vermont that's born of that struggle lives in that political tradition. It is very democratic-minded. It creates for itself one of the most, if not the most, democratic state constitutions. And it is the first state in the Union whose very constitution denounces slavery. So Stevens, who grew up in that atmosphere, he doesn't leave Vermont until it's time to go off to college, is heavily influenced by that. He remembers vividly in years later that his family venerated the most democratic document of the first American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence. The Baptist faith of his parents was a faith born in and prominent in the English Revolution of the 17th century that brought down the English monarchy, and it prized personal conscience, personal decision-making, and community cohesion, placed the good of the community above the good of the individual. And that also influenced Stevens and pushed him in the direction not only of individual rights, but of the importance of the community. His mother deeply imbued him with those values, and his mother lived those values before his eyes.
Lincoln's initial priority wasn't the abolition of slavery, but it was in keeping the Union together after the southern states seceded. The Civil War commenced when troops from South Carolina fired on a federal fort. The North could not have been won without the participation of former slaves, and Lincoln came to realize that. Approximately one-eighth of the Union Army was made up of these men. What did Stevens do to push Lincoln in this direction?
Stevens began calling upon the Union government to bring black men into its lily-white armies virtually from the very beginning of the war. And Lincoln resisted doing so, as Lincoln resisted so many of the things that Stevens advocated and which Lincoln was eventually compelled to agree with. And Stevens kept up this relentless pressure and helped thereby to increase public opinion in favor of doing so. That is something he did in general across the board with policies that, again, Lincoln initially resisted, but which Thaddeus Stevens made it possible for him eventually to accept precisely by helping to prepare public opinion for them. And just as you say, Lincoln eventually comes to recognize that those like Stevens who had been pushing for the admission of black men into the army were right, and that the war could indeed not be won without that radical change in policy. Others who came to see the same thing included Ulysses Grant.
Bruce, your book is so beautifully written. I wonder whether you could read for us. One of my favorite passages is on page 168. Do you think you could read that for us, please?
Okay, I'll do my best. This is a discussion of the 13th Amendment. Success in the House came some 7 months later. On the afternoon of January 31st, 1865, Thaddeus Stevens rose to conclude the Republican case for abolition. Other House members immediately crowded around to hear his words, while senators, Supreme Court justices, and other highly placed individuals filled the galleries and the lobbies. The House then passed the 13th Amendment in a vote of 119 to 56. When the result was announced, the chamber's floor and galleries erupted in cheers, tears, and ecstatic shouts of celebration. Months of both arm-twisting and bargaining had played their part in that outcome, but so had Republican gains during the 1864 congressional elections, likely changing the minds of some Democratic representatives then sitting about which way the political winds were blowing. The 13th Amendment then went to the state legislatures for approval. For the aging Stevens, Congress's endorsement of a step for which he had been fighting for so long could only have been gratifying. His health was declining, as was apparent to those around him. But, he said, quote, "If Providence should spare me a little longer, until the day when the foot of a slave can never again tread upon the soil of the Republic, I shall be content to accept any lot which may await me," end quote. The Ohio Democrat George H. Pendleton accused Republicans in May 1864 of being a, quote, "revolutionary," end quote, party, and demanded they acknowledge it, quote, "Admit you are in a revolution. Admit that you are revolutionists. Admit that you do not desire to restore the old order. Admit that you do not fight to restore the Union. Take the responsibility for that position," end quote. But such a challenge held no terrors for Thaddeus Stevens, who extolled what he called the purifying fires of this revolution, and assured his listeners that, quote, "revolution it is," end quote. By early December 1865, the states had ratified the new constitutional amendment. Slavery was outlawed throughout the country.
Thank you, Bruce. Bruce, along with Donald Trump, Andrew Johnson is considered the worst president ever inflicted on the American people. He was Lincoln's vice president and ascended to the presidency in 1865 after Lincoln was assassinated and the Civil War had ended. What did Johnson do to obstruct Reconstruction, and how did Stevens respond to that?
From very early after assuming the presidency, Andrew Johnson begins pardoning wholesale the leadership of the now dead Confederacy and restoring to them all their rights except the outright ownership of human beings. The consequence is that as early as the fall of 1865, the states of the dead Confederacy are now acting as though they are full-fledged members of the Union once again. They are electing their own state legislatures and filling them with leaders of the ex-Confederacy, and they are sending Confederate leaders and generals and colonels to the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate. The Republicans refuse to allow this to occur and block it and begin to try to implement a more severe form of Reconstruction and eventually begin passing civil rights legislation and begin crafting what becomes the 14th Amendment. Andrew Johnson vetoes the civil rights law and tries to veto the 14th Amendment and encourages the southern states to refuse to ratify the 14th Amendment. When Congress places the states of the ex-Confederacy under the ultimate control of Union generals who are charged with protecting the lives and the rights of former slaves as well as of those whites in the South who had been loyal to the Union, Johnson moves to restrict the power of those generals and then begins to replace them one after another with those he considers more liable to be complicit in the white supremacist action of the southern state leaders.
If Stevens would have had his way, what would Reconstruction have looked like?
Well, first of all, he would have denied them the rights of other states. Those states, the states that formed the Confederacy in 1860-61, declare they're out of the Union. Thaddeus Stevens says, fine, they're out of the Union. Let us treat them as such. Let us treat them as what they really are, an enemy alien state. And once we have conquered them, treat them as what they are, in fact, conquered enemy provinces. Let us rule them directly from Washington as we do all other territories, and let us use that rule to enforce not only the abolition of slavery, but the enactment of equal civil rights, equality before the law, insofar as we restore self-government. Let us require the extension of that suffrage to adult black men, and let us furthermore provide an economic foundation for greater democracy in the South by taking all the estates owned by the slaveholding aristocracy, the richest slave owners, confiscate that land, divide that land into small farms, and distribute it among those whose labor had cultivated that land and made that land profitable in the first place. Meanwhile, let us strip the leadership of the old Confederacy of its rights to vote and its rights to hold political office. And in that way, let us make sure that we reshape the South into genuine egalitarian democracies.
Bruce, what is meant by reparations? And do you believe Stevens was an early proponent of reparations? Now, reparations are under consideration by many in America.
Well, I understand reparations to mean doing something to compensate slaves and those descended from slaves for the very fact of enslavement, and moreover, for the era of Jim Crow that lasted approximately a century after the end of outright slavery. To do something, to give something that would enable the lifting of this still oppressed portion of the population out of the bottom tier of American society. I think Stevens although he didn't use these words, was, of course, a proponent of reparations, because that's what dividing plantation lands and giving it to the former slaves constituted, an attempt to give back what was taken away in the first place, the result of centuries of unpaid labor by those slaves and their ancestors.
Stevens was not only for enfranchising black males, but he was for other progressive things as well. Bruce, please elaborate on his position on women's suffrage and the rights of Chinese immigrants.
Over the course of his life, Stevens' commitment to democratic causes grows. It is propelled forward not only by his early values, but also by the problems that arise before his eyes in American society. And so he responds by deepening his commitment to democracy. And thus it is that on the eve of the Civil War, Stevens in Lancaster places himself on the side of those arguing in favor of women's right to vote. And at the same time, when members of his own political party, the Republican Party in California, come before the United States Congress asking it to enforce one or another provision that will make life even harder for the impoverished immigrants from China who are reaching the shores of California, Thaddeus Stevens not only refuses to support such measures, but denounces the state of California for its treatment of those immigrants and insists instead that they have every right to come here, that this is supposed to be the land of refuge and freedom, and that California is casting shame upon itself by its conduct toward these residents.
Your book is remarkably timely given the upsurge of 20 million people led by black Americans in the streets in June last year. How do you relate Stevens to the current Black Lives Matter movement?
If Thaddeus Stevens were alive today, and if he were ambulatory, which he was not in his last years due to illness, but if he were, he'd have been in the midst of those marches. Thaddeus Stevens, all through his life, fought against racist violence committed against black people. And that kind of racist violence was eventually key to the process of overturning Reconstruction in the South. In the almost immediate aftermath of the Civil War, white riots against former slaves broke out in one place after another in the former Confederacy, most bloodily in the cities of Memphis and New Orleans. And the rioters, by the way, in both cases, included large numbers of white police. And that is another fact that has been characteristic of the entire era since the end of the Civil War. White police violence directed against black people, supplemented by white supremacist vigilante violence against white people, against black people, which we've also seen in the last year or so. So Stevens would have been an active supporter of Black Lives Matter today.
Bruce, how has your book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary Fighter for Racial Justice, been received?
Well, Heidi, it's still early. The book has only been in print now for about 2 weeks. I'm happy to say, though, that most initial reactions have been very positive. A number of authors whom I respect deeply and whom have received accolades for their own work have said very kind things about the book, which my publisher has thankfully reprinted on the back of the book. And in the first week or so of sales, about 1,000 copies of the book have been sold in one format or another. So far, the book bids fair to do well and hopefully to influence popular opinion in its own right.
We're coming to the end of our allotted time, but let me just ask you this. What would you like people to take away after they've read your biography of Stevens?
Well, I hope they'll be reminded of a number of things. First of all, how old racism is in this country, how deeply rooted is the oppression and victimization of African Americans in this country, but also through the example of the Civil War and the fight for equality during Reconstruction, what courage and determination can accomplish in struggle against those things. Thaddeus Stevens, I hope, will help inspire people, even more than they already may be, to fight hard and long for the achievement of genuine political and social democracy in the United States.
Bruce Levine, it's been a great pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Your book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice, published. We're glad to hear that it's doing so well, and we're grateful to be able to speak with you today. You take it easy.
Thank you so much for having me on, folks. I appreciate it a great deal.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.